evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, January 7, 2015. The ruling SPLM party says free and fair elections can and will be held in June this year.
With elections, irrespective of any other challenges, the only thing that we can do damage, the big damage we can do to South Sudan, is not by abiding by the constitution. Because on July 9 in the morning, there will be no legitimate government. Nobody can remove us unless to actually ridicule us that, these guys are even saying illegitimate.
And South Sudan government gives a strong warning to the rebels of the SPLM in opposition.
If the rebels attempt to attack us again, we will give them a hot pursuit and will not stop except when we reach the place where they usually start from.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The ruling SPLM party says it is preparing for general elections scheduled to take place in June of this year. Party officials say the elections must be held in June, according to the country's transitional constitutions. Civil society activists strongly disagree. Philip Thornaleu has more for VOA from Juba.
Achuil Malinu Bangol, SPLM secretary for popular and syndicated organizations, says the ruling party fully supports conducting 2015 elections.
With elections, irrespective of any other challenges, the only thing that we can do damage, the big damage we can do to South Sudan, is not by abiding by the constitution. Because on July 9 in the morning, there will be no legitimate government. Nobody can remove us unless to actually ridicule us that, these guys are even saying illegitimate. So the only thing to close this chapter is to make sure that by all costs, the election must take place.
South Sudan transitional constitution does not provide an exact date for holding elections, but does state that President Salva Kiir's term will end by July 9th of this year. And if no election is held by that date, the presidency will be considered vacant, and the vice president will assume the top executive post until a vote is organized. Last week, the chairperson of South Sudan National Elections Commission, Professor Abednego Akuk Kachwal, announced his organization will hold presidential, gubernatorial, and parliamentary elections on June 30th. Mali says SPLM members at the county and state levels will take part in meetings expected to be held over the next few months to pass parties' constitution and select members for all elected positions. Mali says unless the two warring parties in South Sudan's conflict reach a peace deal before the elections, the SPLM in position led by former Vice President Riek Machar and the former detainees will not take part in the meetings.
It is not only in South Sudan that the party get fragmented and form many sub-parties. So yes, we consider them people who have left us. We'll continue, do our level best. It is our hope that they come back. If they come back, we reconcile. And that's why our effort is a lot being done now in Arusha. So if they come, silent. If they don't come, what do? We have to continue because we have a mandate.
Civic society activists say holding elections in June is not a priority for South Sudanese. They say the government should direct its energies toward reaching a permanent peace deal and end the fighting. Ijo Elias Odengo, executive director for South Sudan Network for Democracy and Elections, also points out that a census must be conducted before elections take place.
If we do elections without census, that means we have abrogated the constitution. And also, when we look at the time frame is very short to organize elections, all the process of elections within a 6 months period.
Odengo says the National Elections Commission has yet to establish structures at the state and county level as stipulated in South Sudan's Election Act of 2012. And he says this parodic fighting, which continues in Jonglei, Upper Nile, and Unity states, means citizens in those areas will not be able to exercise their constitutional right to vote.
Looking at the practical situation on the ground, we are not in a peaceful situation. There is conflict. It's very difficult to reach. And even our people in the state, the politicians who will go and campaign, it will be very difficult for them to do it. It will not be an easy task if we talk of practical aspect.
On top of that, Odongo says the fact that Pew South Sudanese can read or write means voter education must be conducted before elections are held. Women rights activist Rita Martin says after what South Sudanese have been through this past year, they are not psychologically prepared to vote in June. And she dismisses the government argument that South Sudan is not the first country to hold elections while in the midst of a major conflict at home.
We have been hearing that elections have been done in Syria, elections have been done in Sudan before while the country was in conflict. But then, what is good about that? What are we learning about that? So I think we should not just be a copycat of other people doing it, but we are not seeing what good comes out of it.
Martin says the priority for both the government and the rebel should be to end the fighting and restore peace in the country. She says having a permanent peace deal will restore hope for the nearly 2 million people displaced by the conflict and pave the way for democratic and internationally recognized elections. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleu in Juba.
South Sudan's government spokesman has warned that continued rebel attacks on government forces are likely to undermine last year's cessation of hostility agreement and heighten the ongoing conflict. For VOA News, Waki Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Information Minister Michael Makuelweth alleges that attacks by rebels aligned to former Vice President Riek Machar are getting worse, especially in the northern part of the country. Makwe spoke with reporters on Tuesday and called the rebel attacks provocative. He says the attacks are likely to escalate the fighting.
If the rebels attempt to attack us again, we will give them a hot pursuit and will not stop except when we reach the place where they usually start from. No going back, no return from there.
Both warring parties, government and rebel forces, continue to accuse each other of provocation. Since December 31st, fighting has raged in the oil-producing Unity and Upper Nile states in violation of the cessation of hostilities agreement signed in January 2013. Makwe warns that the fighting may endanger the on-again-off-again peace talks that began last January. The talks were adjourned until further notice in December by IGAD, the East African Regional Bloc that is mediating the negotiations. Makwe says that if the peace process resumes, the talks
may not be of any help if the rebels continue with their flagrant violations.
Makwe says the government wants to see the fighting end while the talks continue.
If the rebels have decided to opt for war, then we can do it. We are ready to face them. And if they are for peace, we are ready to face them. However, the government is for peace. We have been calling for peace despite the fact that the rebels are in violation. If they have opted to continue fighting, meanwhile talking, we are ready to do the same.
The fighting is now in its 13th month and has devastated much of South Sudan's infrastructure and left the fledgling country vulnerable to instability. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu from Juba.
Still on fighting, the UN Refugee Agency reports conflicts like the one in South Sudan forced a staggering 5.5 million people to flee their homes during the first 6 months of 2014. In its new report, the UNHCR says these newly uprooted people added to the 51 million people who were forcefully displaced worldwide by the end of 2013. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
At this rate, the UN Refugee Agency fears another record of people forcibly displaced may be set by the end of this year. The new trends show from January through June of last year, 1.4 million people fled across international borders, becoming refugees. The rest, more than 4 million people, became displaced within their own countries. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards tells VOA that Syrians, for the first time, have become the largest refugee population, bumping Afghans, who have held that position for more than three decades.
Syria has really been the war that's changed everything. Almost 10 million refugees and internally displaced people as of mid-2014. Those numbers are still rising. One in every four refugees that UNHCR is today dealing with is a Syrian. Syria is what happens when a war won't be stopped. And in that region around Syria, where so many refugees are, we're meanwhile seeing that asylum is becoming massively stretched.
The report says the world is beset with a deadly mix of both new and old conflicts. It says relatively new conflicts in places such as Syria, the Central African Republic, and South Sudan are going on at the same time that old conflicts continue to cause havoc for their nationals with no end in sight. The UNHCR notes the 2.7 million Afghan refugees worldwide remain the largest protracted refugee population under its care. After Syria and Afghanistan, the leading countries of origin for refugees under UNHCR care are Somalia, Sudan, South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Burma, and Iraq. UNHCR spokesman Edwards says poor countries and those next to ongoing conflicts bear the biggest refugee burden.
Relative to their population sizes, Jordan and Lebanon are hosting most refugees, almost 1.8 million combined. The biggest economic burden, though, is being felt by other countries. That's Ethiopia and Pakistan in particular, which, relative to the size of their economies, have more refugees than any other country. Major conflicts and displacement in places such as Central African Republic, South Sudan, is also happening. That's in danger of being forgotten by publics and by donors.
Edwards notes African conflicts are not confined to their countries alone. He says the humanitarian and economic consequences for their impoverished neighbors are enormous. He says these countries, though they are least able to afford it, are sheltering hundreds of thousands of refugees, often without adequate support from wealthy donor governments. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa. U.S. President Barack Obama addressing the Ebola crisis.
Ebola is actually a difficult disease to catch. It's not transmitted through the air like the flu. You cannot get it from just riding on a plane or a bus. The only way that a person can contract the disease is by coming into direct contact with the bodily fluids of somebody who is already showing symptoms. We know how to fight this disease. We know the protocols. And we know that when they're followed, they work. And if we take the steps that are necessary, if we're guided by the science, the facts, not fear, then I'm absolutely confident that we can prevent a serious outbreak here in the United States, and we can continue to lead the world in this urgent effort.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the man rebel leader Riek Machar has appointed as a shadow governor of Western Bahr al-Ghazal state describes his vision for the future. That story is coming after this break.
South Sudan In Focus listeners can find us on the following shortwave frequencies: 11900, 13870, and 15180 kilohertz. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan, or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan In Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
who should be responsible for teaching young people about sex education?
I think parents will be in the best position to do that job. Because when the kids go out to school, of course, we can say the teachers can do their part, but you are in the house with them. They spend most of their time with you, the parents. So the best way is for the parents to take up that responsibility of teaching them.
I can see this is the role of the whole society. The parents can play a role at home, and then the church or Islamic places or even religious places have the responsibility to teach children about sex and how they can practice self-sex.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. An analyst with the U.S.-based Enough Project, which seeks to end genocide and crimes against humanity, says the reported surrender of a top Lord's Resistance Army commander, is a significant step in the move to bring LRA leader Joseph Kony to justice. A man claiming to be Dominic Ongwen turned himself to U.S. forces who are helping the Joint African Union Regional Task Force in Central African Republic. Ongwen, Kony, and other LRA commanders have been indicted by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity. Enough Project policy analyst Holly Draginis tells VOA's James Batty that Ongwen's defection will have a major psychological impact on other LRA commanders.
It really signals a further weakening of the Lord's Resistance Army. It also really signals and triggers an opportunity for justice for victims. The victims of the Lord's Resistance Army's brutality throughout northern Uganda, Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Central African Republic really deserve to see justice served. And Ongwen's surrender means an opportunity for that.
Your organization thinks that eventually there should be justice. How does justice come?
Well, the ICC has indicted both Kony and Ongwen for multiple counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity, including the widespread murder of civilians, enslavement of civilians, including children, as well as pillage of personal property, especially in IDP camps. We know that he and his forces oversaw some really brutal acts, especially against some of the most vulnerable populations in this region. The ICC has had years to amass robust evidence against these individuals, interviewing witnesses and victims.
Now, your organization is accusing Joseph Kony and the LRA of what, illicit trafficking? Any proof of that?
We've done extensive interviews with defectors who were once within the ranks of the Lord's Resistance Army in Congo and Central African Republic and formerly in northern Uganda, who say that when they were in the ranks of the LRA, have been involved in illegal trafficking of diamonds and gold as well as ivory, that orders to traffic those natural resources and to steal those natural resources came from Kony himself. We know from multiple sources, again, that this is a group that uses natural resources to fund their activities and their atrocities.
Earlier this year, I think there was a report that a senior commander of the LRA had been captured. What does this say in terms of the hunt for Joseph Kony? The African Union forces, are they making progress?
Yeah, these events really show that the counter-LRA mission is working, that we need to keep up this mission and really continue the support. It's a really comprehensive effort by multiple governments in the region along with the United States. And that comprehensive approach, that cooperation across borders is really proving to weaken the group and more efforts are needed. But this is really a benchmark in the fight against the LRA and the fight against atrocities in general.
Could it be that another sovereign country is harboring Joseph Kony? Because why has it been so difficult to get him?
A lot of the areas of especially the Central African Republic and South Sudan have been safe havens for Joseph Kony. And for logistical and political reasons, a lot of those areas are hard to reach. So more progress is needed to give that mission the mandate and the capacity to reach those safe havens where Joseph Kony and his forces hide in order to finally...
That's Enough Project policy analyst Holly Draginis speaking to VOA's James Batty earlier today. Now we turn to our story about Western Bahr al-Ghazal. Last week, we told you the SPLM in opposition announced the creation of 21 federal states in South Sudan, as well as the appointment of several state governors and army commanders. Yesterday, VOA got hold of the man rebel leader Riek Machar appointed as the governor of Western Bahr al-Ghazal state. That man, Tingo Peter, says the SPLM in opposition is running a parallel government in South Sudan and that it's only a matter of time before the government of President Kiir is overthrown. VOA fellow Nabil Biagio talked to Tingo Peter and has this report.
Tingo Peter says his appointment as governor of Wau State reflects the importance of the region and shows that the conflict in South Sudan has reached a crucial stage. He says it's a big responsibility that has been given to him by former Vice President Riek Machar, but he's up to the task. Tingo says he's part of what he calls a new legitimate structure of government in South Sudan, one headed by Machar, which trickles down to 21 federal states created by the rebel leader. Tingo says we are a government that can be called a shadow government or a parallel government to the one based in Juba. He says its legitimacy stems from the revolution led by the people of South Sudan against President Salva Kiir. South Sudan's constitution states that President Kiir's term in office ends in July, as does the entire current government if no elections are held before July 9th. Tingo asserts that President Kiir lost his legitimacy a long time ago. So did the current governor of Wau, Rizik Zakaria, who was democratically elected. He says both President Kiir and Governor Zakaria are illegitimate because they violated the constitution by killing innocent civilians in Wau and Juba. The events in Wau took place in December 2012 when civilians publicly protested the decision of relocating Wau County Administrative Headquarters to Ngoba Gari. At least 10 protesters were shot dead by government security operatives. In Juba between December 15th and December 18th of 2014, when fighting broke out at a military barracks on the outskirts of Juba, touching off more deadly fighting around the country, human rights groups say at least 200 Nuer civilians were killed by troops loyal to President Salva Kiir in the Gudele neighborhood of Juba, setting off waves of violence around the country. Rights groups say ethnic killings have occurred on both sides. Tingo says he wants to put an end to the ethnic tensions and describes what else he has in mind for the future. Tingo says when he takes over, the town's wealth will be shared by and for the people of Wau. Under the new federal system, he says, Wau would retain 70% of its wealth and natural resources for development, while the remaining 30% would go to the federal government. Even though he has been appointed by Machar, it is only in name. Tingo continues to reside in Khartoum. South Sudan in Focus tried to reach Governor Rizik Zakaria to respond to this report, but he declined to talk to us. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
Turning to Nigeria now, Amnesty International says oil giant Royal Dutch Shell will pay a landmark of $83 million settlement to fishing community in the Nigerian Niger Delta for two oil splits there in 2008. The payout is the result of a three-year legal battle in Britain. VOA's West Africa correspondent Anne Luke has reaction from the Bodo community.
Royal Dutch Shell has agreed to pay more than $53 million to 15,600 people in Bodo, in Nigeria's oil-producing southeast. Another $30 million of the settlement goes to the community as a whole. Each individual will get about $3,200, an amount equal to about 3 years of earnings at Nigerian minimum wage. But it's been 6 years since the spills destroyed the livelihoods of local fishermen and farmers, and the area remains polluted. Bodo community member Patrick Negmaton worked on the case. He sees the settlement as, quote, good news, but not an all-out victory.
The money paid, if you quantify that with the level of damage that is done to the community, cannot also compensate the community, because we are talking about a community where thousands of people depend on their rivers, on their land for survival, and those properties are destroyed. It's going to take several years before those properties can be remedied. So no matter the amount of money you pay, that cannot actually remedy the situation.
Shell says it is, quote, fully committed to the cleanup that is slated to begin in the next few months. The UN Environment Program said in 2011 that it will take 30 years to clean up oil pollution in Ogoniland, where Bodo is located. Amnesty International, which worked on the case, estimates that more than 100,000 barrels of oil flooded into the Bodo ecosystem during just one of the two 2008 spills. Amnesty says Shell had not replaced what it knew were old and corroded pipelines. Shell denied that claim. Amnesty says, quote, hundreds of oil spills from Shell's pipelines occur every year. Shell says spills are caused by oil thieves who tap the pipelines for crude and then refine it locally. The company says the theft has reached, quote, unprecedented levels, and told VOA it loses about 30,000 barrels a day due to thieves. And look, VOA News, Dakar.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. At least 12 people are dead in Paris in an attack on the offices of the satirical weekly paper called the Charlie Hebdo. French officials say three gunmen opened fire inside the newspaper's offices. The suspects remain at large. Magazine director Stéphane Charbonnier and at least three cartoonists were killed. Two police officers are also reportedly among the dead. Known for its irreverent tone, the left-wing magazine frequently comments on people in the news and on religion and culture. Charlie Hebdo published a satirical cartoon on Wednesday on social media depicting Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi as a New Year well-wisher. And security officials say a car bomb has exploded outside a police academy in Yemen's capital, killing at least 30 people and wounding 40 others. Today's blast in Sana'a happened as people were gathered outside the building. There has been no immediate claim of responsibility for that attack. And that's a look at some of today's top news stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, Carol. And that brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Ngote Lelu by Langs and JJ D. Muzika. Been listening to Mr. Langs and JJ D. Muzika with that song Otolelu Alelu, meaning no matter what happens, your mother remains your mother. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could join us here. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.